engineered. Given that Carlin and I had already had one run-in, you can guess which view I'm inclined to take. What matters, though? He paused, nodding slowly to himself. I lost it, Cassandra. Allowed my personal feelings to cloud my professional judgment. You didn't go looking for a fight? No, I didn't. But I should have just logged his presence, left him with a few words to remember me, and allowed him to get on with his rabble-rousing.
And instead?
I used force to bring him in. I was within my technical rights, but it was poor decision-making, and it put the Supreme Prefect in the embarrassing position of having to de-arrest Carlin, then send him back home on our ticket, all of which plays very neatly into his hands. Cassandra Lang's answer was delivered after a solemn interval of judicial consideration.
No way to sugar this one, Dreyfus. You screwed up.
He smiled at her candor. That was my assessment as well.
But you're also only human.
I don't believe in coincidences like that either.
Carlin obviously wanted you seeing red.
That doesn't excuse what I did.
No, but I'm not going to blame you for it.
I didn't like that man when I was alive, and I'm not minded to change my view of him now.
The first time I saw him, it was hate at first sight. That look of his, those pale blue eyes, those golden curls, that calculated boyish twinkle. Can't they see it's an act?
It works for some.
Not me. I'd have wiped that smirk off him, given half a chance. He makes my blood run cold now, just thinking of him. Well, were there repercussions for you?
The Supreme Prefect was very forgiving.
She ought to be. The time you spend on your work? Some advice from a dead woman, Dreyfus. If it comes to the point where you depend on me for absolution, you're in trouble.
It wasn't absolution I was after. Just a second opinion.
Well, you got one. And I think I like you a little better, knowing you have your limits. Was that really all you came to talk to me about, Dreyfus? I'm almost flattered. It makes me feel useful.
You are. You will be, he said.
You're not a bad man, Prefect. A little driven, a little morose. But you can be forgiven for that. You're a policeman of sorts, after all. Now that we've been honest with each other, though, you'd tell me if anything was happening, wouldn't you?
Dreyfus thought back to the white candelabra. There's something I'd be interested in showing you, but I have to tread carefully. It might relate to the wildfire deaths, or it might be a random connection that has no bearing on the larger investigation. He refrained from mentioning the patterning he had noticed on her earlier clothing, but he was certain there was more to it than coincidence. Well, no, soon enough. But in the meantime...
There you are, back to business.
It was not Cassandra Lang who had spoken. The words had come from the person next to him on the bench, but it was not the same woman he had been addressing only a moment earlier. Now his companion was a child woman, a girl of teenage looks, wearing a green brocade gown, gold-trimmed, over a dress of gold and fire-red. Her hair was auburn, parted centrally, framing a face that evoked both commanding serenity and a certain lofty disregard. Blue eyes regarded him, a very particular deep blue, warmer and deeper than the eyes of Devon Carlin, and nothing at all like the green of Cassandra Lang. Dreyfus fought hard to keep his composure.
Aurora.
You shouldn't be startled. It's only been 2 years.
She cocked her head to one side, studying him with increased intensity.
My, you really are taken aback, aren't you? And here was I, thinking this would be the ideal place to meet.
Who was I just talking to?
Oh, that was her, the poor soul. I'm not so unthinking as to spoil such an intimate exchange.
Then what are you doing now?
You'd said your piece, and I was bored with her.
She patted his knee.
She's all right, Dreyfus. Relax. I've just relocated her beta level to somewhere else in this environment, with a local memory reset, so she doesn't sense any oddness in the transition. Can't have her listening in on us now, can we?
How the hell are you here?
I haunt the living worlds. Why shouldn't I extend the same courtesy to the dead?
She gave a little pout of displeasure.
I thought we had a higher regard for each other's capabilities by now.
Your capabilities included attempted genocide.
Let's not dwell on ancient grievances. I thought we'd put all that unpleasantness behind us. Moved on. Haven't we?
There'll never be any moving on. If I could catch you now, I would.
No,
she said sternly.
You wouldn't. Not if you've an ounce of sense left in that meat-stuffed head of yours. You couldn't defeat the monster you imagined me to be, so you let loose another monster to divert my energies. Or had you forgotten about that?
What's your point?
That I mean to put your mind at ease. The clockmaker and I remain engaged.
She gave him a strained, lopsided smile.
Worthy adversaries. Of course, we despise each other, but we must also acknowledge what we have in common. Two compromised experiments in the extension or prolongation of human intelligence. Two victims to hubris and overreaching ambition.
Two psychotic ghosts, locked in endless stalemate.
Don't be so complacent, Prefect Dreyfus. One of us will win eventually, and you'd better hope it's me. At least we have some common values. At least I retain some lingering regard for the value of human lives. That's more than I can say for that mad machine you turned against me. If the clockmaker wins, there won't be enough meat hooks to go around.
I'm surprised you can spare the energy for this conversation in that guise.
I very nearly can't. You were shrewd when you set us against each other, forcing us to become distributed across the networks. If I concentrate enough of my resources in one location, as I must do to speak to you now, in what you laughably call real time, then I become vulnerable to the clockmaker's detection attack algorithms. Already they are alert to this change in my posture, sensing and probing my countermeasures. So we'll keep this necessarily brief, shall we?
Suits me down to the ground.
You have a difficulty. I am aware of it. People are dying inexplicably, and your projections point to a rising curve. Doubtless it's crossed your mind that I might be the cause of it.
Not exactly your style, murdering people in their ones and twos. But then, who knows? Her eyes glittered with a fierce and lively disdain.
It is not my doing. You can accept my word or not. But know this. I depend on the integrity of your networks, on the continued stability of the glitter band for my very existence, and I am rather attached to that existence. Anything that threatens that integrity is of paramount concern to me, and I will not sit back while you bumble your way through this crisis.
Is that an offer to help?
I'd put it differently. An intervention to limit the damage to myself brought about by the limits of human competence. How does that sound?
As if you're scared.
I am,
she said, nodding earnestly.
Scared of anything that does not fit into my understanding of things. And this most certainly does not. Someone or something is out there, Prefect Dreyfus. Something neither you nor I have dealt with before.
Dreyfus absorbed her words, thinking it wise not to doubt the essential truth of it. It's not the clockmaker, playing some double bluff against you.
I don't think so.
Her fingers tensed on the ends of the armrests as she leaned forward.
It tastes different to me, Prefect Dreyfus. There's a mind behind it, a will. I might even say a human will, amplified though it is. But it's not our mutual friend.
You don't know much more than me, in that case.
Oh, but I want to.
The blue in her eyes seemed to flash.
I've come this far, reached this deeply into your security layers. Now let me go further. Open the deep archives. Let me into the search turbines. I'll do no harm. And I can tease out patterns and inferences 1,000 times more efficiently than your Stone Age algorithms.
You infiltrated our deep layers once before, Dreyfus said. You've got to be insane if you think I'd let you back in.
She leaned back in the seat, a pitying look on her face. Then you'll just have to solve this emergency on your own, while the bodies pile up. It's a pretty little pinch you find yourselves in, isn't it?
Dreyfus shrugged. Is it?
From where I'm sitting. Show restraint, and you'll be accused of betraying the public confidence in your promised security. Act forcefully. Take the necessary measures to protect the civilian population. Do the very job you were tasked with, and you'll play into the hands of the secessionists. You'd better hope there's a path somewhere between those two possibilities.
I'll find one.
Aurora nodded. I have to disperse myself now, but we'll speak again before long. And my offer stands. If you want assistance with this difficulty, you'll have to consider the unthinkable. You can't stomach the thought of it now, but it's a wonder what a few more bodies will do. It'll be 100 soon, and 1,000 before you can draw breath. How will that sit on your conscience when you were offered help? She smiled once.
Well, sleep on it.
You know where to find me.
Oh, and Prefect Dreyfus?
Yes.
I'd keep this conversation to yourself, if I were you.
Chapter 9. A day passed. Jane Omanier slept a little. Talia Eng and Sparva Bankol agreed to remain on site at Carousel Addison Lovelace, accompanied by two heavy technical squads and a number of pangolin-rated field prefects. They were beginning to investigate the white structure, moving into it with extreme caution and thoroughness. Meanwhile, a corvette returned Terzet Friller's body to Panoply, allowing Dr. Demikoff to confirm that the cause of death was indeed wildfire. Antal Bronner had been the 54th direct victim of wildfire. Friller could now be entered into the record as the 55th, and the forecast suggested accordingly. Elsewhere in the glitter band, a probable 56th case came in, flagged at a high likelihood by Panoply's event detection triggers. As with Friller, there was no chance of recovering ahead before the neural structures were hopelessly compromised. Nonetheless, prefects were dispatched to bring back the body for inspection. Another day passed. A probable 57th case arrived barely 28 hours after the first, an ominously short interval. This time a field prefect was near enough to attempt head capture, but the neural patterns were again too degraded to offer any significant leads. The forecasts were recomputed. Depending on the statistical weighting applied to various factors, the 57th case appeared to hint at a marked steepening in the death curve. This left Omanier disconsolate, but she refused to leap to premature conclusions. She would wait for the 58th, 59th, and 60th cases, before revising her expectations. She hoped that, when those deaths arrived, they would drag the forecasts back to their earlier slopes, as if those were not already bad enough. Internal prefect Vanessa Lauer, meanwhile, had executed a preliminary search on the white structure, finding only exceedingly sparse priors. The name of the structure was Elysium Heights. It was registered as a private medical facility, and behind it stood a murky chain of ownership. From a legal standpoint, everything that was obliged to be disclosed about the structure had been, but beyond those terse requirements, there was not a single shred of reliable information. But again, Omanier resisted the urge to jump to conclusions. Although it looked suspicious, there would have been thousands of facilities running under similar conditions of confidentiality, and it did not necessarily imply dark motives. A commercial clinic, tending to a wealthy client base, she speculated, would have been within its rights to run its affairs very stealthily. Dreyfus, meanwhile, had extracted a valuable joint confession from the primary and beta-level instantiations of Giselin Bronner. The entire statement had been recorded, but Dreyfus had summarized the essentials to Omanier in person. Giselin Bronner admitted to her part in the scam to defraud the Ultras, but the principal architect had been her husband, Antal Bronner. "She said he was drawn to risk," Dreyfus said. "Always had been. Doing legal business with the Ultras wasn't enough for him, even with a modest profit. He had to up the stakes, and drew his wife into the scheme. He knew there was a chance they'd be found out, but living like that was part of the thrill."
"Then we're back to your theory that a propensity for risk-taking links the wildfire cases."
"All right. I'm inclined to give it more credence. But Eng sent that candelabra back to us for a reason, and you thought the widow might have something to say about it. Did she?" "Antal was driven by something," Dreyfus answered. "Haunted, more like. If the Bronner instantiations aren't lying, then he never spoke about it in depth to either of them. But over the years, Ghislaine pieced together a partial picture. Something had happened to Antal before she knew him, something he either barely remembered or was barely capable of speaking about. He'd been involved in something, on the few occasions when it slipped out. All he'd say was that it was a kind of game. Whatever this game was, it took a dark turn. Something very bad happened. Antal got out, but it had left its mark.
And the candelabra?
Somehow related. That's all she knew. Antal was troubled by flashes, night terrors, daydreams, half-forgotten imagery. A white tree, or something like a white tree, standing alone. It seems he commissioned the candelabra to confront his fears, or familiarize them to the point where they no longer had a hold over him. Have you searched for a similar link in the backgrounds of the necropolis, Betas? Something played across Dreyfus's face then, some fleeting thing which she almost read as guilt or regret. I've made some inquiries. Some of the Betas seem to be drawn to similar imagery. Cassandra Leng, for instance, had a pattern of interlocking trees on her clothing. Paulette Stang had a neck brooch with a tree-like form. Lucas Clay spends his time circling a bare white tree in one of the parks in Necropolis. There were others. But if you push them on it, there's no overt recollection. I think it's most likely that the Betas are picking up on subconscious cues displayed by their primaries, without any deeper understanding of what that imagery signifies. Perhaps we should ask them directly about Elysium Heights. A simple question, with no contextual explanation. There'll be a risk of cross-contamination, but at this point, I'm not sure I see an alternative. I'll ask, Dreyfus said.
Good. When you're done, I'd like you to go to the building itself.
Eng and Bancala due a break anyway,
and a fresh pair of eyes won't hurt.
I agree.
I'm glad you do.
It'll keep you out of trouble with Devon Garlin, if nothing else. I may as well mention that he's stirring up trouble again, after we released him. I'm not terribly surprised. Would you like...
No, Tom. I think not.
If I had a way of keeping you and Garlin several light seconds apart, I'd take it. It's become personal for both of you. He made it personal. Maybe you don't quite understand that. She cut him off before he said something he might come to regret. My mind's made up, Tom. I can't afford to take my eyes off Wildfire. The latest forecasts are... troubling. I'll say no more until we have a few more deaths under our belt. But even our worst projections may turn out to have been overly optimistic. It makes it all the more urgent to pursue the investigation into Elysium Heights. She thought of that conversation now, as she floated free in the middle of the spherical room where the scarab had held her for 11 years. A mosaic of displays wrapped the room from pole to pole, each facet representing a feed or status indication from one of the habitats under her care. All 10,000 were indicated, although most were too small to snag her immediate attention, appearing as little more than coloured, flickering swatches. By deliberate command, Omanier had lately arranged for more than 2 dozen habitats to be under permanent close scrutiny. Their facets were enlarged, their feed summaries comprehensive. Spotted around the room's globe, there were always 2 or 3 in her immediate field of view. By long habit, she rotated her viewpoint, and the room occasionally cycled the displays if it detected something that it believed merited her interest. 8 of these facets represented the habitats that had already declared their breakaway status, formally nullifying their ties with the wider glitter band. The remaining facets, around 20, although the exact number went up and down from day to day, represented the habitats that were more at risk of following the initial 8. For one reason or another, they were all associated with anti-panoply sentiment, making them fertile ground for Devon Garlin's separatist rhetoric. He had visited all of them in the last 6 months, and if his words could not have been said to have been met with universal approval, there was certainly a groundswell of sympathy among the citizens. Now, one of those 20 habitats was becoming particularly problematic. The name of the place was House Fuchsin-Nimburg, and had she placed a wager with herself as to which of the 20 was liable to tip the earliest, that would have been her choice. It appeared that Devon Garlin, an exceedingly shrewd man for all his faults, had made exactly the same calculation, deciding that was where he next needed to apply his leverage. A day or two after his release from Panoply, he had rejoined his loose organization and travelled to House Fuchs in Nimburg on a private shuttle. That was his right, and Aumanier had made no effort to stop him. She had assumed that after his brush with Dreyfus, it would be back to business as usual. There would be public speeches, public rallies, a slow spreading of the rot, but nothing that demanded her immediate engagement. If she could hold it at the present level, manage and monitor its spread in a controlled fashion, it would give her time to resolve the melters. Aumanier allowed herself a rueful, private smile, thinking of the way she had chastised Sparva Bankol for using precisely that term. The neural overloads, she corrected herself, much more dignified. But melters was a lot quicker off the tongue. The smile evaporated. It would be quite a while before it returned. She studied the feeds, assembling a mental picture of the unfolding events. Garlin had broken from his usual script, she saw. It had started with a public rally, more vociferous than usual, more outraged, and it had drawn a larger, more boisterous crowd than the norm. But that had only been the start. Garlin had recounted his brush with Dreyfus in Hospice Idlewild, giving a self-serving account that made it seem as if he had been the victim, rather than the provocateur. Aumanier sifted through the captured recordings, isolating a fragment of audio-video. Garlin was up on an outdoor platform, grandstanding, shaking a clenched fist, rage boiling off his face. "This was a direct infringement of my civil rights under the common articles. They say free speech is sacrosanct until the moment it doesn't suit them. I was made welcome by the good people of Hospice Idlewild, but that didn't sit well with Panoply. Perhaps they're afraid of the truth? Certainly they were fearful enough to use physical force against my innocent associates. Excessive, painful, physical force, which I myself experienced." He made a show of rubbing his wrist, as if it was bruised. "To add to this travesty, I was bundled off to a prison cell and subjected to interrogation and threats from the Supreme Prefect herself. I was told that if I continue saying my piece, merely speaking the truth, friends, that I'll be silenced, and woe betide anyone who shares my convictions." Then he bent down, leaning in with conspiratorial content, dropping his voice an octave. "They're listening now. You can be sure of it. Using all the instruments at their disposal. They're in our heads, eavesdropping through our eyes and ears. There's a poison at the heart of the glitter band, and they put it there. But it's not too late to do something about it." Aumanier ground her teeth, sensing what was to come. "They've humoured us until now," Garlin was saying, "allowed eight habitats to strike out for a better life, unfettered by Panoply's dictatorial rules. But now they've decided enough is enough." His eyes seemed to meet hers, as if they were staring at each other in real time. "I got that message very clearly, thank you, and I understand that the game has changed. From now on, Panoply will use every tool in its arsenal to suppress free debate and deny the public will. I know. I've seen it for myself. Mark my words. They'll soon be on their way. Prefects, ships, weapons, but that's only because they're scared. All too aware of how fragile their hold on us really is. How little it would take to snap the chains. Good citizens of House Fuchs in Nimburg, surely I don't need to remind you of the sort of injustice Panoply is capable of inflicting on its own people. You've seen it for yourselves. You know what they're capable of. The lockdown imposed on you 72 years ago. There was a murmur of approval, the consensus broken only by a few sceptical voices. Garlin appeared not to hear them. Aumanier could imagine his bodyguards gently encouraging those dissenters to step further away. She stopped the playback, needing no further reminder of the thorn still in her side. Dreyfus was wrong about one thing. He thought he was the only one personally affronted by Devon Garlin. Perhaps he had cause to feel singled out, given what had happened in the hospice. But Aumanier had dedicated her life to the preservation of the glitter band, She knew its moods, its desires, its hopes and fears. For all its flaws, for all its imperfections, for all that it still contained, little knots of darkness and cruelty, she believed there were infinitely worse ways to live. It was not such a bad thing, this endlessly circling river of light and lives. It had given itself over to her care, and she took that singular burden with the utmost seriousness. No, there was no one alive who took Devon Garlin more personally than Jane O'Money. It was a relief to find only the ordinary ghosts in Necropolis, the walking dead of the sequestered beta levels. Dreyfus walked the parks and lawns until he found Cassandra Lane, strolling through an ornamental garden, set with elaborate metal and stone sundials, all shadowless on this overcast day.
"Did one of us offend the other?"
she asked. "It's just that I remember we were talking about various things, and then perhaps it got a little personal for you. But then I was somewhere else, and you weren't there."
"It wasn't you," Dreyfus said, "or me, for that matter. Just a glitch in the system."
"Given that I only exist because of this system, I can't help but find that worrying."
"I don't think it'll happen again," Dreyfus said, injecting a warning tone into his voice in case Aurora was listening in. "Anyway, there's no risk to you or any of the betas. We take very good care of our witnesses."
"There's something you're not telling me, Dreyfus."
She turned her elfin face to him with a guarded expression.
"I thought we were beyond that sort of thing by now, that we had some basis of trust."
"I've always told you all I can, and I do trust you. It's why I'm here today, as it happens. Can you help me gather up the others? There's something I need to show you all."
"A breakthrough?"
"I wouldn't go that far. But a lead, at least. Something we didn't have until now."
"And how many dead is it now?"
57. "But there's a hint that we're seeing a steepening in the death curve."
She stroked one of the sundials, frowning at his answer.
"That's not good."
"If it's real, we'll have a better idea after a few more cases have come in. It's not that I'm wishing for more dead, but each new instance does help our projections."
"And how bad does it look, exactly?"
"Right now, we're due to hit 1,000 cases in a little under 300 days. I don't like that, but it does give us time to conduct our investigation and put in place a response plan before the crisis becomes unmanageable. If it steepens appreciably, though..."
"Will it?"
"Someone's pulling strings, Cassandra. That's my feeling. Or tightening a noose. I think it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better."
"You said you've learned something."
"I don't know how much you remember of our conversation the last time, but I was about to show you an evidential item. We can come back to that later. But this thing I want you all to see is related to that item. It would be good for everyone to see it, I think. Then talk about it and see if it jogs any memories."
"Couldn't you just snap your fingers and have us all magically appear?"
"I could. But it would be better if you went and asked, I think. Like it or not, you're always going to be the first victim. That gives you standing, a position of influence, whether you wanted it or not. I've seen how you talk to the newly arrived, helping them adjust to their new situation. You're kind to them. You might not believe in the point of your own existence, but you believe in them."
"If being your go-between gives me something to do in the afterlife, who am I to complain?"
"You're more than that."
"Do you really believe so?
I thought all you hard-nosed prefects were supposed to treat us as bundles of evidence, with no more soul than a box of photographs." "That's how we're encouraged to think. How we should think, if we're doing our jobs properly."
Dreyfus paused, uneasy with himself, knowing that his world would be a much simpler and more straightforward place if he held to the official line.
"I believe it, too, most of the time."
"I would have thought it had to be one or the other."
"That's generally the idea."
"Then you are a man of odd contradictions."
"There was a witness once, a beta level, like yourself. She left me with doubts. Her force of personality was very strong.
When we spoke, I couldn't shake the sense that I was addressing a living soul. A real person. In which case you might be the last person in the universe who believes in souls. Dreyfus allowed himself a smile. I don't know if I believe, but I know I'd be a better policeman if I stopped having doubts.
Better, she said, but not necessarily kinder. Well, I'll be sure to tell you when I start feeling something in myself.
You believed in life once, he said forcefully. That's why you tested yourself to the limits, to give that life meaning, even if it meant taking dangerous risks with your own existence. Those suicidal games in the Colfax orb. That was your right, and I won't judge you for it, especially as it wasn't the games that killed you. All I ask now is that you accept there is still some meaning to what you are.
You have quite a philosophical streak.
There's nothing deep about me, Dreyfus said, but I like to think I know life when I meet it.
And speaking of life, in the real world, are you still in trouble for what you did to Devon Garlin?
A minor blot on my record, to go with all the other blots on it. I've made mistakes before. Doubtless I'll make a few more. No, that little storm has blown itself out for the time being.
Ah, then you still feel there's some unfinished business with that man?
That's up to him.
Well,
I told you I didn't like him, so you won't hear any argument from me.
Have you ever taken an immediate dislike to someone, Dreyfus?
Not usually a good idea in my line of work.
Hard if you can't help it, though. I'm afraid that's how it was with Devon Garlin. As soon as I saw his face, I knew no good was going to come of him.
Almost as if your paths had crossed before. She seemed to consider the thought before dismissing it.
I think I'd remember if Avoy had ever had anything to do with me, Dreyfus. But I know his type, as well as his family background. That casual assumption of power, that easy way of making people see his point of view. Some men are born knowing they're better than the rest of us. Frankly, I'm not sorry you got to push him around a bit.
I'm afraid it did more harm than good, and I doubt very much it will have changed his personality. He paused. Do you know the terrace on that outcropping at the end of the lake?
I'll round them up, Dreyfus. Don't you worry.
Half an hour later, Dreyfus mounted a low platform to address the gathering. He surveyed the faces, all of them familiar by now, their names coming to mind with no great effort. In truth, it was only a small achievement to remember them all. There might have been 57 confirmed victims of wildfire, but there were still only 48 sequestered beta levels. Terzet Friller, for instance, had left no known beta level, and Panoply's legal apparatus was still working to issue the relevant sequestration orders for the two most recent deaths. Long before they reached the present number of cases, though, Dreyfus had convinced himself that the solution to wildfire lay among these walking, talking dead, and not in the overcooked brains of the recently deceased. But Dreyfus was a man who set his stock in patterns and connections. Once the dead overwhelmed his capacity to hold them in his head as distinct individuals, with names and faces and histories, he would have surrendered his usefulness to the search turbines. Yet, now more than ever, he believed the connection was real and identifiable among these 48 betas.
Dreyfus asked me to summon you, Cassandra Leng said, addressing the 47 other betas, not all of whom were pleased at this unscheduled gathering. That's as much as I know, though.
She turned her eyes on Dreyfus, holding his gaze for a private moment before adding,
"So whatever reason he has for moving us around like chess pawns, it had better be a good one."
"Thank you, Cassandra," he said, nodding at her. "And thank you all for agreeing to meet here. I know that each and every one of you has a desire to see your death explained, and any guilty parties brought to justice. But along the way, you have had to be patient with my questions, and there are times when I simply can't be as open with you as I'd wish. I understand the frustration."
"We've already been over everything," said Simon Morago, the 18th victim. "Every detail of our past lives, everyone who may or may not have had a grudge against us."
"Give him a chance," Cassandra Leng said.
"He's trying hard,
trying to treat us as people, not patterns of data. But he only has so much time.
Then he'd better hurry up and come up with something good, Morago said.
I can't promise miracles, Dreyfus said, making eye contact with as many of the dead as he could. What I can promise is that we won't leave any stone unturned, especially if it hints at a linking factor, something in your past you all share. Now, we think we may have found something.
Antal Bronner, standing near the front of the gathering, said, I haven't been here as long as most of these people, but I still feel as if we've been over and over our histories. If there was some secret we all had in common, wouldn't we have stumbled on it by now?
Not necessarily, Dreyfus said. My suspicion is that your living instantiations may have had direct dealings with a place, a facility, and that what happened to them there may be connected to wildfire. Equally, you may have been denied direct knowledge of this link. Your primaries might never have spoken of their involvement with the place, or even taken steps to suppress their own memories. But there may have been bleed-through.
Bleed-through? He heard someone murmur in a mocking tone. You were created to emulate your primaries, to stand for them when they could not be present, Dreyfus said. You were also curated. Your primaries got to decide what you did and didn't know, and they also had the option to shape your responses to certain stimuli. You're all idealized in one form or another. A blemish removed here, a quick temper there, an unfortunate or embarrassing episode in your primary's past. Why would you ever need to be troubled by that?
Is there a point to this? Asked Morago.
If we don't know, we don't know.
Dreyfus searched his memories before answering.
Years ago, I interviewed the sequestered beta of a person suspected of involvement in vote doctoring. The primary protested their innocence, as you would. Despite extensive questioning, the beta appeared to have no overt knowledge of the crime. But during the sessions, the beta kept touching a brooch. The action had no direct significance for the beta. It was merely a learned gesture from the primary, empty of meaning. Later, I established that the primary's brooch contained an illegal device that allowed them to submit multiple fraudulent votes. The beta had picked up on the significance of this brooch without any direct knowledge of the crime itself. That's bleed-through.
And you think it applies to us? Cassandra Leng asked. We're not criminals, Prefect. Just law-abiding citizens who happened to die by some unexplained means.
I agree, he said, meeting her eyes again. But there's still a possibility that your primaries had knowledge denied to you, such as the significance of this building.
What building?
Simon Morago asked. Dreyfus smiled. He had been ready for the question.
The one behind you, he said.
It had formed while he spoke, shaped to rise from the island in the middle of the lake. They turned, in ones and twos to begin with, then en masse. It was an accurate representation, reconstructed from the images and scans sent back by the heavy technical squad. A slender off-white trunk rising high, with angular branches emerging from its upper levels to support a cluster of globe-shaped secondary buildings, suspended from the branches like fruit.
Its name, he said, is Elysium Heights.
Chapter 10. They were returning from one of Caleb's hunting games. It had started well enough, as the games generally did. Soon enough, though, Julius had ended up in a squabble with his brother. Caleb wanted them to have actual weapons, conjured out of quick matter. Julius had objected, and they had nearly come to blows. Caleb had stalked off in a huff, Julius catching up with him, and now they were walking back to the shell house in a tense, broody silence. Something burst in Julius. He stopped Caleb with a hand on his shoulder, feeling hard muscles tense in response.
What is it?
Caleb asked, turning.
I had a dream again. No one's interested. No one cares. When we were little, you told me you had the same ones. I was lying, just saying whatever you wanted me to say, to get you to shut up.
Caleb turned away and kept walking.
No,
Julius said, calm despite himself.
You weren't lying. Maybe you don't have the dreams anymore, but you used to,
and it was about the same place I keep dreaming about.
You mean the place with the Ursas?
Caleb said mockingly, not looking back. Those stupid robot teddy bears, or whatever they were. What else was it you used to go on about?
I know you remember it all, whether you want to or not. The metal corridors, the dormitories, the windows looking out.
Do you know where it was, Caleb?
Not here. Not the Shell House. But it has to be on this planet somewhere. It's Yellowstone outside those windows, but nowhere close to Chasm City. It means we weren't born here, within the city limits. We were brought up in some other place, and they don't want us to know about it.
Caleb glanced back, putting on his best scornful face.
You're an idiot, Julius. If we'd been raised somewhere else, why wouldn't we remember?
We do,
Julius said earnestly. It means someone didn't want us to remember, so they tried to scrub away the memory,
so we'd grow up here and only ever remember the Shell House. But there's something else behind it, slowly coming through. We were there together, but Mother and Father aren't there. Just the other boys and girls, and the Ursas, whatever they are.
He walked on for a few paces before delivering his coup de grace,
and something really, really bad happened there.
It's not a real place,
Caleb said, some of his earlier assurance gone.
But you dream about it as well. Only because you've put the idea of it in my head. There's blood,
Julia said.
A lot of blood. And dead boys. And dead girls. All cut up. All lying on the floor. But we're still alive. We're standing up and everyone else is dead.
He swallowed hard.
There's blood on us, too. But it's not our own blood. We're all right. But we've got knives in our hands.
Julius and Caleb had learned to make a point of arriving earlier than any given appointment. There was a chance of catching their parents in the strained end stages of some discussion or argument, one that would have been silenced by the time they were meant to arrive. Often all they picked up was a snatched word or sentence, but over time it was enough to assemble a picture of what their parents would never have shared in their presence.
He has a temper,
she said now, her voice low.
So does Julius, their father answered. They're strong-willed boys. After what they went through, would you expect them to be any different?
It's worse with Caleb. Julius flares up, but he doesn't hold on to things. Caleb does. He's not ready for this, Marlon.
If you had a say, he'd never be.
I love them both. I want them both to be happy. They already have everything laid at their feet. They can go out into the world and make us proud. They don't need this. Not Caleb, and maybe not even Julius.
We've been building up to this moment for years. Why are you having second thoughts now?
Because if we don't have them now, there'll never be another chance. You can't take back the gift of fire, Marlon, and that's what you're about to put into their heads.
This city needs us. The world needs us. The quiet guiding hand of a void. It's always been there, barely sensed, barely used, but always ready. Millions have come to trust in our guiding wisdom. We can't let them down now.
Mother gave a sigh.
You'll allow me power of revocation. At least give me that.
Marlon sounded relieved this was the only concession expected of him.
Yes, of course. Full revocation rights. And I have the same. If either of our senses that boys are drifting...
Good,
Mother said tersely.
But we don't give up on them even then. We'll continue their education, bring them back to the point when they can be trusted again, as I know they will be.
I wish I shared your optimism.
There's no other choice for us, and no other choice for them. But if we have to revoke it, we will.
Julius knocked on the doorframe.
We're here,
he said, feigning breathlessness.
Sorry we're late.
Julius is getting better at conjuring, Caleb said, effortlessly falling into the same lie.
He wanted to show off what he can do now. I need to look to my laurels. He's starting to get quite good.
But no threat to you yet, Caleb, Mother said, her words carrying a darker implication, given what the brothers had overheard.
Come in, anyway, and try to learn some punctuality, both of you.
They knew this room well enough, although they had only been allowed in it on a few occasions. It was called Chandler's Room, after Chandler Prentice Voy,
and most of its windowless space was given over to Chandler's solid orrery. Julius had found the solid orrery fairly impressive the first time he had seen it. Supposedly, it had been a gift from the technicians of Panoply, grateful for Chandler Prentice-Voy's help when its terms of operation were being decided. With the right conjuring commands, any part of the solid orrery could be enlarged and inspected, down to an almost insane level of magnification. Julius had proved that to himself once, by zeroing in on Yellowstone, and then finding the eye-shaped atmospheric smudge that marked the location of Chasm City. He had enlarged the city, making it swell out of the side of the planet like a malignant growth, and he had peeled back the main dome and located the greenish swatch, surprisingly small, that was the open area containing the wooded estates, of which the Voy home was only a small element. The solid orrery had only let him go as far as the family dome, though, refusing to let him peel it back to see the shell house. All the same, though, he had come to think less of it once his own implants were up and integrated, and he had full access to the consensual information field. Anything made of mere matter looked a little tawdry and limited compared to the sensory riches accessible through direct neural stimulation. Yet there was something different about it today, a kind of pearly glimmer to its details, an inherent lack of focus, as if he saw it through tear-stained eyes. Fine, glinting threads seemed to bind its elements, as if a spider had been crawling around it overnight, trying to fix a web to its endless, shifting geometry. Caleb glanced at him, his look confirming what Julius was seeing.
"Why does it look like that?"
Julius asked. "It's an abstraction layer," Father said, "a separate visual overlay, augmenting the quick matter realization."
"We realized that," Caleb said.
"The purpose is to indicate the flow of abstraction packets," Father said, looking at the boys in turn. "Trillions of packets flowing from world to world, from core to core, from mind to mind. Abstraction queries, polling results, communications, even the basic instructions underpinning the shaping of quick matter and the consensual field, the gears that grind behind every human thought, every human whim, the great work of Sandra Voy, laid bare." He grinned at his sons, while Mother looked on with nothing but apprehension.
"Beautiful, isn't it? I don't think there's anything lovelier."
Julius and Caleb glanced at each other, Julius certain that his brother shared the same thought. It was pretty enough, but if their father expected them to be bowled over by it, he had underestimated both of them.
"I see you need some convincing," Father said.
A soft smile creased his lips.
"A ballot is pending in the glitter band, some minor matter of interhabitat relations. The corps are beginning to return the results as each citizen registers their vote. Packets flowing between worlds, from the corps to the hubs and routers to the central collating systems, all under the supreme and watchful eye of Panoply, ensuring that democracy proceeds without friction or impediment."
Father stretched over, reaching an arm into the solid orrery. His fingers tweezed at one of the fine, twinkling threads. He pulled with thumb and forefinger. The thread stretched, as if it were on the point of breaking, and then snapped back to its original configuration. But something glinted between his fingers. He relaxed back to a normal standing position, still pinching a dancing silvery spark between thumb and forefinger. He brought it close, studying it with a certain lustful fascination, the way an ogre might regard a fairy.
"This is a packet,"
he said, his eyes crossed together and gleaming with the reflected twinkle of the tiny spark.
"Or more accurately, a linked bundle of packets, signifying a returning vote. Perfect, integral, self-correcting. But for the moment, it's not going anywhere."
The boys looked on. All of a sudden, Julius had a thousand questions. But one thing was already clear to him. Father was not making some theoretical point about something that could or might happen. This was real. This was now. His father had actually reached into the solid orrery and stopped the vote in its tracks.
"No one can do that,"
Caleb said.
"He's right,"
Julius put in.
"The system's foolproof. That's what Sandra Voy gave us."
"Sandra Voy gave us a little more than that,"
Father said. Julius was beginning to feel quite disturbed by that dancing glint. He wanted Father to put it back, to let it go on its way, to restore the right and proper way of things. He had the feeling Father had unpicked some vital thread from the corner of reality, and if he kept tugging at it, the whole thing was in danger of unravelling. But it was Mother who took up the explanation.
Sandravoy was a genius, but she was also a pragmatist.
Our Demarchist system is as perfect as it can ever be.
Flawless, instantaneous, mass democratic participation, the will of the people without interference, no government, no hierarchies, no vested interests, no possibility of bias or corruption.
But, Julius said. Mother raised a gentle, silencing hand, and he let her continue.
But true democracy embodies the possibility of its own dissolution. If a ballot were put to the people to abandon our Demarchist principles, and the votes carry the day, what then? You may say that no such vote would ever be cast. But that is to neglect the pressures that may apply during times of crisis, during emergencies and times of economic hardship, or when wild and seductive new ideas run rife. Sandravoy took the long view. She knew that even the most perfect system must contain a self-protecting contingency.
We are that contingency, Father said. Sandravoy
designed a safeguard into her system, Mother said. Not a loophole or a weakness, but a deliberate feature. It allowed Sandra to guide the hand of democracy, to keep it from undoing itself, or from making choices it might come to regret. It was a subtlety, built into the neural architecture, at a level that would allow it to pass all scrutiny. Each generation of voice has known of this contingency, and each has borne that knowledge with dignity and restraint. Ours is not to use this power flagrantly, but always to be ready to use it when the moment calls.
Please put that vote back, Julius said.
Father smiled tightly, but obeyed Julius. He reached back into the solid orrery, and the glint spread from his fingers, losing itself almost instantly in one of the twinkling threads.
The system will know something went wrong,
Caleb said. It will sense that the vote was delayed.
No,
Father said, not without a swell of pride. That's all taken care of. The contingency passes all error-handling routines. Deceives them, you might say. I could have snuffed that vote out of existence, made it never reach the collating systems, and no error would have been detected at any level.
This isn't right,
Julius said.
No one's meant to interfere with the system, not even us. It's not interference,
Caleb said, surprising him.
It's self-preservation. Isn't that right, Father?
It's a necessary duty. An obligation, Father said. One to be treated with the utmost respect. And so it's been. In the years since the founding of this city, the contingency has been evoked only a handful of times, and on each occasion with a heavy and reluctant heart. His attention shifted from Caleb to Julius. Something still troubles you, son. Julius swallowed. He was still shocked by what he had seen, but he took it at face value, not for a second doubting that the show of power had been genuine. Now, though, his mind was flashing ahead, evaluating the implications.
You delayed a vote, and you say you could have stopped it registering at all. I believe you.
But a vote here and there never makes enough of a difference to matter.
He's a smart one, Mother commented.
Julius is correct, Father said, nodding at both of his sons. What I just showed you was only the simplest demonstration of our capabilities. But if that were all we could do, we would still be powerless. When the world's pull, even the most closely contested results often hinge on majorities of many millions.
You can't affect that many votes, Julius said.
Not the way I've shown you, Father agreed. Not by picking at a packet here, a data bundle there. But we still have influence on the scale necessary to effect change. If the shimmer is the weather, then we can shape the way the weather varies. He returned his attention to the solid orrery, but instead of dipping his fingers into it, this time he held his hands before him and made a sort of conjuring gesture, the way one might persuade a chair to assume one form rather than another. Julius and Caleb studied the results, watching as an invisible breeze seemed to play across the web of data threads, buckling and trembling them. "Now there's a delay across multiple core returns," Father commented, concentration tensing his facial muscles. "But again, the error correction routines see nothing out of the ordinary. No word of a problem begins to reach the ordinary monitoring systems, let alone Panoply." He relaxed his hands, letting out a sigh, "and the vote proceeds as it would have done, except for a barely detectable delay in processing the returns. But I could easily just have cast a portion of those votes into oblivion, or transformed a million returns from one type to another, enough to swing the result, had I so chosen." "I want to know how to do it," Caleb said. Julius felt obliged to go along with his brother's enthusiasm, even though he had decided misgivings.
"Yes, me too. That's why we're here, isn't it? You wouldn't show us these things if you didn't mean for us to be able to do them, and I know we can." "You have the talent," Mother said. "Both of you are very good at shaping. But there's more to this than technical ability. It's about judgment, responsibility, restraint, knowing when not to act, as much as knowing when. Sandra Voy did not mean for this gift to be used for our convenience. It was always a tool of last resort, to safeguard that which she held most precious, democracy, freedom, the universal will of the people." "We're ready to take on this responsibility," Caleb said solemnly. "Aren't we, brother?"
"We can be,"
Julius said. But the truth was that he felt as cowed by the idea of that burden as he was stirred by it. It was one thing to carry this name, another to be told he was now expected to save society from itself. He felt as if he was being made to grow up between one morning and the next, denied all the carefree years he had counted on.
"Julius has caution,"
Mother said, giving her son an admiring nod.
"Caution is good," Father said. "Laudable.
But the boys have been readied for this responsibility, and they must rise to it." He was addressing Julius and Caleb now. "The transition need only be gradual. Your mother and I have many years ahead of us, many good decades in which we hope to be of service. If the contingency must be invoked, then it will be our decision. But you will learn from us, and under our close supervision, you will be entrusted with certain obligations." He spread his hands grandly. "This will be your classroom from now on, the solid orrery your only subject, worthy of study. You will immerse yourselves in the shimmer, learn to feel its moods, its tides, its great and silent heartbeat. You will sense the coming and going of votes, but that will only be the start of it. The entire flow of information through the abstraction is yours to sample, yours to swim in, yours to shape. You will see more, and know more, than anyone alive, and through that seeing and knowing, you will become wise beyond your years, understanding more than anyone what is at stake, what glories would be lost, if this were to fail. The bounty of contentment that would slip from our grasp, where once our hold on it seemed unassailable." Julius had the sense that his father was repeating words that must have been said to him at a similar age. But he straightened his back, listened hard, and tried to measure up to the job expected of him.
"How will we know,"
he asked, "when it's right to intervene, and when it's wrong? How are we meant to know?"
"You are a Voy," Father told him. "That is all you need to remember, Julius."
Caleb took his arm, not ungently. It was more brotherly affection than he had shown in quite some time.
"It's all right. I know we'll be all right. It's hard, but we'll never let anyone down. Don't give us cause to be disappointed," Mother said.
Caleb raised his chin. It was on the calculated edge of defiance.
"We won't, Mother. Julius and I are good on our own, but we're much stronger together. Aren't we, brother?"
Julius nodded, but he did not meet his mother's eyes while he did so. He was thinking of blood and of knives. By the time Dreyfus docked, 4 days had passed since Briggs' death, but from the agitated mood of the other workers, it might as well have been a matter of hours. Dreyfus found it hard to blame them for their belligerent mood, with Briggs' death coming so soon after the demise of Terzet Friller. They were fed up with being fobbed off with non-answers, and they had his sympathy. "I'll be straight with you,"